Hey everybody, Chris Webster here to talk about one of the latest supporters to the Archaeology Podcast Network, The Motley Fool. Now, I've been investing in the stock market through various applications for a few years now, and everybody who's listening to this can benefit from that sort of investment for the long-term financial planning. And also, I know the hosts of these podcasts can benefit because as archaeologists, like none of us get retirement, we all have to kind of fend for ourselves. So investing in the stock market is a good idea, but not everybody can do it. And look, we get it. The market is complicated and confusing, and to many of us, it simply doesn't make sense. In fact, where do you even start? Take all of the guesswork out of it with The Motley Fool Stock Advisor. The Motley Fool has been around for over 25 years and has been spot on in recommending some of the world's most important companies before they hit the big time. I'm talking about Amazon, Tesla, Netflix, Starbucks, all before they exploded in value. With their easy to use and super informative service, Stock Advisor, you could join the ranks before they potentially find the next big thing. After all, their average stock recommendation is up over 400% as of April 10th, 2023. And no need to be intimidated by financial jargon or market complexities. As the name suggests, these guys don't take themselves too seriously. Now, finances, that's a different story. Their friendly and relaxed approach has helped over 700,000 people move closer to financial independence, all while beating the market and having fun. New members can access Stock Advisor for only $89 for their first year, a full $110 off the full list price. Don't sit on the sidelines and think about what could have happened. Visit fool.com/APN to start your investing journey today. That's $110 discount off of $199 per year list price. Membership will renew annually at the then current list price. So again, check the link in the show notes of this episode.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Archaeology Show, episode 241.
On today's show, we talk about where we want to go when we become archaeology time travelers.
Let's dig a little deeper into that fractured timeline because it doesn't matter. We made a new one. Welcome to the Archaeology Show.
Hello.
So if you are in bed getting ready for sleep, welcome to your nighttime archaeology program.
It is so funny to me because we hear so many people saying that they fall asleep to our show, and it's just a thing. People fall asleep to podcasts.
Yeah.
I've heard, like, not just our show, but like lots of shows. That's what people do.
I've rarely heard advertisers get on board with that and like putting in a few, you know, oh, sleep mask ads, yeah. Or here's one for Ambien.
Right. You know?
Something like that.
Or like a soothing voice to like purposely put you to sleep, like in the middle of the ad.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, some people who sleep very deeply are time travelers because, you know, if you time travel into the future, which is possible, generally you're going to have to sleep for a really long time and hopefully your body doesn't age. But actually, that's
sure,
possible.
Sure, okay. I guess that connects to sleep.
No, it is possible. Okay. So just looking at that. Well, I saw this article called From Historical Holidays to Archaeological Sites, Top Destinations for the Time Traveler, which is misleading because I was very excited.
Yeah.
It's from a outfit called The National. And it's actually just a collection of tour agencies and tours and, you know, specific tours that you can do in certain places.
Yeah, it kind of sounded like I didn't realize they were going to be advertising to us when we were looking at the article. But I mean, I'm not mad about it. You know, we've just recently come off of a really big trip and, you know, knowing what cool places there are to visit from an archaeological perspective is always a great thing to do research on. These trips in this article are like crazy expensive, so I don't really think that that's the right fit.
Right.
For a lot of people
right.
because of that. But it is nice to know like what is out there. And so this article was fun for that reason.
Yeah, I wanted to bring up just the first few of these, and we are not affiliated with any of these or get any money out of this.
And honestly, we're not even endorsing doing these tours. It's just cool to see what kind of places you can go that are archaeologically focused.
Keep in mind, too, we have a guest that's going to be coming on in a couple of months here that I talked to, and she actually does tours in Egypt, and we might have something special in store for that as well, but we'll talk about that later. Regardless, she actually told me that, you know, some of the tours that they offer like this are usually geared towards older people.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they're even mobility challenged, but it's like 40 or 50 senior citizens, which isn't a big deal,
but
you got to know what you're getting into with some of these tours, right?
Well, older people are the ones who tend to do tours like this.
Yeah.
And if you like a more fast-paced sort of itinerary, which I think we do, we like to move quickly and see lots of things. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
So just keep that in mind. And that's probably why the cost is so high on some of these, because it seems like
they're luxury.
Well,
they're bougie.
Not only are they luxury, but they're like fully in hotels and airfare's covered in some of these.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, all your meals are covered. Yeah. It's just, you know, it's fancy.
It's fun to read and dream, though, for sure. Yeah.
One of these first ones is called the Human History Expedition, which is really cool, by National Geographic. Mm-hmm. It is a 10-day trip, which includes access to three archaeologists. That's kind of how the article was written. I don't know what that means, if like you meet them up at certain places, or it was curated by an archaeologist, or three of them.
Are they like local archaeologists, or are they people that travel with you from National Geographic? That was not really super clear. But either way, I'm sure it's knowledgeable people who can explain the secrets of wherever you're going.
But you see lots of stuff. Mm-hmm. It is impressive what you get to go see. It starts out by saying, go back 40,000 years, see cave carvings and paintings from the Dordogne to Basque Country. Basque Country. Sorry, not Basque County. I'm sure there's a Basque County too. I don't know.
Probably.
Yeah. Anyway, there might be in Nevada, actually. No, there isn't.
No, there's not.
Actually. Okay. So, and you go to the Lascaux Caves in France, which is a UNESCO World Heritage Site. Keep in mind, no one goes in the Lascaux Caves in France.
You can't actually go in those caves. They've been closed to the public for, I think, a long time now. Yeah.
Yeah. But there's a...
For preservation purposes.
There's an exact replica nearby with the museum that you can go in. And it's supposed to be very impressive. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But you know what? To be honest, I don't think I'd go all the way to Lascaux for a replica. Like, I could probably see that in VR or something.
Yeah, right.
You know, if I'm going to see a replica, I can see that anywhere.
Yeah.
So,
but you get a feel for the terrain and like what it would have been like to be a human that is going into these cave systems, you know, if you're actually there. So there's, you know, that'd be cool.
You go to Atapuerca, which I believe is in Spain, maybe Portugal. It's over there on the coast somewhere. Mm-hmm. But that's where Europe's oldest known hominid fossils were found. That's according to this article. I'm not sure that's totally true still, but it's at least very old hominid fossils.
Yes.
Yeah. And you get a lecture there from a leading expert on Paleolithic art, which is really cool.
Atapuerca is where the Cima de los Huesos is, I think, the cave pit.
No,
that might not be where they're going for this tour, but there are a lot of really old, lot of really old hominids there for sure.
Another cool thing about this trip is they make a prehistoric meal made from ingredients used by Neanderthals thousands of years ago.
Oh, that's cool.
I'm like, so the paleo diet? That's pretty much what you're... Yeah.
Well, I'm sure it could be really good though. Like, we've read some articles where they recreate the meals and it sounds pretty delicious.
And I guess you stay in high-end hotels in medieval towns.
Yeah.
And for all of this, and I didn't say whether or not airfare is included to the start point, but transportation once you get there is included, and food and lodging. And it's about $9,000 per person.
Oh, it's so pricey.
That is a lot. I mean, that's almost $1,000 a day. And that's...
Per person.
That's crazy.
That is a lot.
Now, if you like staying in high-end hotels and eating great food, I mean, you're going to pay at least $500 a day for that.
The thing is if you cannot afford a trip like that, it's still great to read a resource like this because they're going to give you the highlights of where to go and then you can DIY it,
Make your own trip.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
There's another one here called Highlights of Albania.
I'm so into this idea. I want to go to Albania. It looks so cool.
It says it was 5,500 DH, which is... I'm not really sure what method of currency that is.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
And I didn't bother to do the conversion. So, you know, go check it out if you want to.
Yeah.
But you see Byzantine and Roman histories because that's, you know, Albania.
Mm-hmm.
That Albania was, I kind of didn't realize how close everything was, but Albania is right next to Croatia when we were there.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, crap, Albania is right there.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
So
I know that because of Eurovision. That's how I know where any of the countries in Europe are that are kind of smaller and not as like well known in America. Tristan's probably cringing right now if he's listening.
I'm sure. Yes. So this one starts in Tirana, the capital of Albania. And there's Italian architecture because probably the Venetians.
Probably. And definitely the Venetians. It's always the Venetians.
And Ottoman buildings and mosques. And you see several UNESCO sites. There's UNESCO sites all over that area.
Mm-hmm.
A 5th century castle that was once home to a military leader whose name I can't pronounce, but he also went by the Dragon of Albania, which is pretty
sweet.
That's
a very cool name.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is from responsibletravel.com. I linked separately to some of these in our show notes. Not all of them, just like the first four or five. So you can go check those out. But for the rest, you'll have to go to the actual article, which hopefully I can find the actual article because it's an Apple News article. And sometimes we can't find these in the real world.
Yeah, we'll link to it as best we can.
Yeah.
But
Then there's Highlights of Ancient Greece, which I thought was fun.
So we did DIY this tour, yes. Basically.
Yeah.
Well, although we didn't go to everywhere, but...
We did not. Yeah, it starts in Athens, goes to the Mycenae area, medieval castle of Mystras. Mm. Also Corinth, where there was a Roman forum, temples, fountains. Mm-hmm. You get to spend the night in ancient Sparta, which is really cool. Yeah, includes breakfast, shared lodging, domestic transportation, all the stuff. And that one's $2,235, it said.
Yeah.
Which, that sounds pretty reasonable.
Actually, yeah, that's not too bad. You know, for what you get. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we've been to Greece, obviously, and Greece is very affordable once you get there.
Yeah.
You know, everything was so much cheaper than we expected, like food-wise and lodging and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So it is a very affordable place. It's a great, great place to go and experience the archaeology for sure.
And what I like about some of the remaining ones, they're all under 4,000 British pounds is what they were in. But a lot of them are under 3, some are under 2. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, that's cool is, you know, you think of going on tours and like we did a self-guided audio tour of the Acropolis, like we mentioned, right? And we've done stuff like that before. But these tours that are listed here are more itineraries.
Yeah.
For seeing themed things. You know, you've got one that starts at the Standing Stones in Scotland, but you see a bunch of Scottish stuff. You see the Viking past of Denmark and Sweden, Jordan's history of the Crusades, explore old Europe and Bulgaria. And it's just really cool that it's a whole, it's not like one thing. It's just like you go with the same group and
it's like a bunch of different things. A theme of the area or the people that were there or whatever it is.
Right.
The whole idea is really cool. Yeah.
Yeah. So if you want to know what you want to do and you're trying to figure out a vacation and you're just like, wow, where do I go? There's so many things to see. I would check out some of these tours and then figure out if you want to pay for one of those tours or just kind of steal their itinerary and do it yourself.
Yeah. Cause like when you start thinking about what ancient sites are interesting and what you want to see, there are an overwhelming number to choose from. And I think it is really easy to like default to the big things, the pyramids,
right?
Ancient Greece, obviously, Rome, but there's so much more out there to see and you might be able to do it more economically. You might find some more things that are more interesting to you, depending on what you care about, what you like. Yeah. So, yeah. And what do you care about and like to see?
Well, we will talk about that probably in segment 3, but in segment 2, coming up on the other side of the break, on the off chance that time travel to the past is made viable within our lifetimes, we're going to talk about the rules you're going to need to follow. Back in a minute.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy 2, get 2 free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to episode 241 of the Archaeology Show.
The Time Travel Archaeology Show.
The Time Travel Archaeology Show. Now, this is not to be confused with another great show on the APN, Tea Break Time Travel.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Yeah. We're not trying to steal that idea.
No, we're not.
Right.
This whole article that we read, just because, you know, we're always like researching articles and reading about archaeology in the news. And this article just like sparked this whole idea about time travel to the past. So,
Lots of people, but like what archaeologist hasn't considered time travel?
Oh, for sure. I love time travel fiction too. Yeah. Like I read that kind of stuff all the time.
Right. Speaking of time travel fiction, it provides a lot of the rules that we'd probably need to follow if time travel were real. Cause some people really hit the nail on the head.
Yeah.
They do the research. They try to figure out, you know, to make their stories, their movies, their whatever, a little more believable, right? Yeah. Because it gets you in there.
They do try. Yeah. I always find that there's head scratch moments when with certain types of time travel plot lines. So
there is nothing wrong with Back to the Future.
you have to just like let it be what it is and that's fine. But
okay, let's talk about that real quick. So Back to the Future, it exploits one of the early thoughts about time travel, which is more than likely not true because it would cause chaos in the world. And that is you go back to your own timeline. You don't fracture into another timeline. Mm-hmm. But we now know with the many worlds theory and the many universes theory and the multiverse and the whole thing that more than likely you just spawn in a completely new existence and a new timeline when you go back in time.
Which that like really hurts my brain so badly that I almost like don't even want that to be the way it is. Because how could there possibly be another timeline? That's it's so hard.
Because it's a quantum reality.
I know.
Yeah.
Quantum is hard.
Quantum, it's similar to the Heisenberg uncertainty principle where you can only measure, that's not the one. That's where you can only measure speed or distance, but not, or speed or distance or direction, but not both speed mm-hmm. or direction. We have somebody who works at NASA that's listening to this going, Chris, get it right.
I know. He's going to be like writing in.
I know. The email is being written as we speak.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. It's anyway, fine. We deserve it.
Yeah. One of the people that has one of those sci-fi shows pretty much everybody has watched that has traveled into the past, but they never bring this up when they go into the past. It's only in the present. And that is Star Trek.
Yeah.
And the Prime Directive.
Yeah.
My question is, first off, I think the Prime Directive is bullshit. If you can get
there. Like, aggressive.
Who cares if you're, you know, helping somebody along? You know, maybe they need some medicine. It doesn't really matter. The Prime Directive is too strict, too rigid.
Yeah.
They try not to interfere at all. They always interfere.
Right.
But they try not to. And that's their Prime Directive.
The thing that I always get stuck on is if you bring back something crazy with you, like in Outlander, for example, which is one of my favorite time travel mm-hmm. history things, shows, fiction, whatever. And Claire brings penicillin back to right. the, you know, 1700s with her. And I'm like, well, yeah, they didn't have that yet, obviously. But who's to say that, like, you know, she didn't, her bringing that back in the 1700s didn't actually cause it to be discovered when it was, like, in a roundabout sideways way, you know? Like, maybe it had to be that way.
If I'm not mistaken, but I haven't read the books, but in the first series of the TV show, didn't she go through the stones and like her clothes were left on the ground?
No.
Like you go through naked?
Oh, no. She dropped like a shawl or something. But no, you don't get naked.
All right.
No.
Never mind.
You can bring stuff.
All right. Well, anyway, the Prime Directive. If you go into the past, I think that it would be okay to help other cultures because you're not affecting anyone's future. Because you've created a new
future. You've created a new timeline.
You won't destroy your ability to go back in time.
Yeah.
And the statistical likelihood, depending on how far back you go, of you actually doing that, of you actually changing the future to the point where you don't exist, is so unlikely.
Yeah.
I mean, you'd have to do something catastrophic, like divert the asteroid that landed in 65 million years ago, right? I mean, you would have to do something like that in order to really change the planet and change time.
Well, it depends on how far back you go and all that kind of stuff, too, because like if you don't go very far back in time,
sure,
you could have an effect on your immediate relatives,
right.
You know,
I mean, everybody talks about killing Hitler when he's a baby.
Yeah.
You know, but like somebody else will just get pissed off and take over, right?
Yeah.
That's like, I don't know. Anyway, so does changing the past alter the future? As we're saying, if, you know,
if you're on a different timeline.
Yeah. If they're to be believed, it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
Which also means you probably can't ever get back. Something else to consider. If you decide to travel in time, you're traveling in time for the rest of your life.
So
and
you're
if
not,
you try to come back, you won't be able to.
You can't just like jump from timeline to timeline. Like I want to go back and see this place and then go to this place and then go to this place and then go to this place.
Now, that's an interesting thought because, again, we're getting into quantum mechanics, right?
Yeah.
So if other realities exist, then theoretically, at some point, we should be able to go between those realities.
Mm-hmm.
But if the laws of the universe are different in that reality, your body may not be able to handle it, right? If it's only slightly different, you probably can. And most realities are a fraction of a millisecond different, right? You make one decision, like my decision to sit at this desk to record the podcast versus the other desk. That's a different decision, right?
Right.
Our decision to record the podcast at all.
Yeah.
You know, that's another decision. And there's a reality where I did choose not to record the podcast or you chose not to record the podcast. And we're driving into downtown Charlotte right now. There's a reality where that's happening.
See, this is where you start losing me. And I just want to go back to the basics and say, okay, here's our rules. Our rules are that we don't really care much about the Prime Directive.
Sure.
We're not worried about changing the future. And we can go to whatever timeline we want as many times as we want to.
Right.
Those are the rules that I'm like creating for my personal history time travel.
So some of the things I wrote down for what I would kind of want to do in the past versus not really where I would want to go. We'll talk about that in segment three. Well, at least I will.
Yeah.
But what I would want to do is I'd want to excavate in the past. I want to bring some tools and I would like to see the science of it because I'd want to say, go back to, you know, a 10,000 year old site that we've worked on, maybe, you know, something like that, like that downtown Miami site that we've talked about in other shows.
Yeah.
I'd like to go back like about 5,000 years and see what it looks like then.
Yeah.
And hopefully there's nobody living there, but we know there is.
Yeah.
But if we had the ability to excavate at that time and see
fill in
how,
the picture a little bit better.
Yeah. See how the shorter history has changed.
Yeah.
Right? And see if there's stuff further back that 5,000 years from then is just no longer viable. Maybe the acidity of the ocean has taken it away. Maybe, you know, something else. So,
well, with a lot of sites that we've excavated and just excavations in general, they are layers upon layers upon layers of different occupations and different histories. So if you're trying to get to the oldest levels, and it's hard to do that here today in this time.
Yeah.
But maybe if you do go back 2000 or 5000 years, you can get, you don't have those later occupation mm-hmm. levels, and then you can just like get straight to the one that you're trying to learn about. It would yeah. be an interesting idea. But then, so then my mind gets all wrapped around it, and I'm like, well, if you go back 2000 years and excavate so that you can find out like whatever happened in the older occupation, I have two questions for you. Number one, what does it look like in... Wait, that's so confusing. I'm going to break my brain. What? My first question is, what does that do to that excavation in your regular time? Because you were excavating there and you wanted to get older, but you couldn't. So you decided to go back 2000 years.
Again, this is
different timeline. Okay.
This is why there has to be a different timeline, because I wouldn't have been able to excavate and even know where I was going in the past,
yeah.
which is my future, and say... You know, and then go back to this site. I wouldn't know it existed.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
So I have to be able to create a different timeline.
All right. Well, I thought of a bigger, better question.
Okay.
Why do you want to go back 2000 years to excavate a site that is, let's say, 2000 years older than that, when you could just go back 4000 years and see the site get created to begin with?
Because I like to see site formation processes.
Okay.
So, you know, I took a class in grad school on fluvial geomorphology, which is basically mm-hmm. how rivers move. Mm-hmm. And it was just so fascinating. And when you start learning about that kind of stuff, and you're flying over the Midwest, for example, and you see all these weird lines, and you can start tracing the path of a river that's mm-hmm. 20 miles away now,
right?
And see all these little lakes, and you know that, oh, that's an Oxbow Lake that was created by a channel of this river 10,000 years ago, right? Mm-hmm. And I just would like to see how those things really change. Now, we have a lot of ideas on site formation processes and how things work, but I always want to know, did we get it right?
Because yeah.
archaeology, I mean, I'd say we're probably 90 to 95% certain in a lot of cases on certain things, right? Mm-hmm. When it comes to dating, when it comes to, you know, other stuff. But in reality, we can never be 100% mm-hmm. unless it's historic archaeology. Because if we have records and we have journals,
records, yeah,
if yeah. we have that kind of thing, then sure. But yeah. if it's anything without any sort of written evidence or pictures or anything like that, then we're just making a really good educated guess.
Yeah.
And I want to know the truth.
Yeah. Okay. That's fair.
Yeah.
I get that.
Well, that's why I'd also like to interview people in the past.
Yeah.
Again, I don't think this would have any lasting effect on their culture. They would just, I mean, we have evidence of that now. There's quote uncontacted tribes right now in this world mm-hmm. that are just completely cut off from civilization and always have been, mm-hmm. but they know civilization exists. Mm-hmm. It doesn't change the fact that they're running around in loincloths with arrows.
Yeah.
They know that there's airplanes flying overhead. They see boats out in the water, mm-hmm. but they just don't want a part of it.
Yeah.
And I have no doubt that somebody in the past would feel exactly the same way.
Right.
Now you might hit that one person that's just like, oh my God, I need to like change my life and, you know, start an industry.
Right.
I mean, that's crazy, but they're probably not going to make that happen.
Well, I mean, the thing that we're missing from all of the excavations that we do as archaeologists is the first person perspective, right? You
yeah.
don't have any primary resources because there just wasn't written records
yeah.
depending on where you're excavating. So having that would be really valuable. So yeah. that would be cool.
And finally, to end of the segment, I would have no problem grabbing stuff and bringing it back with me. Because first off, I'm not going back. I'm going yeah. to a different future. Mm-hmm. But hopefully it's a future that was similar to the one that I left and the similar things. Because mm-hmm. I'd like to grab some of those things and then, you know, have a better analysis of them mm-hmm. while they were fresh artifacts, you know, be able to date some of those things, be able to do
some
stuff.
Well, you know the date.
I know the date, but I want to be able to play a little more around with that.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Have some more concrete evidence of when it actually was.
Mm-hmm.
You're right. I mean, if I take something from 5,000 years ago to the future, it's not going to age 5,000 years.
No, it's not. And
yeah.
then it makes me wonder if like people will think that you're a fraud, right? Like people who don't right. believe in time travel, they're going to think, yeah. well, that thing's not 5,000 years old. It doesn't
right.
date properly to be that old. So
yeah.
yeah. But I mean, I guess I don't see a problem with bringing artifacts back as long as you're not trying to like profit off of it, I guess,
yeah,
or like
well,
change
you know,
history or
yeah,
yeah I
There's
think that,
that
it gets weird and sticky, but
right.
yeah.
All right. Well, on the other side of the break, we're going to talk about some very specific places and things and stuff we'd like to do if
yeah.
we were able to time travel in the past. Yeah. So if you're still awake, join us on the other side. Welcome back or to or from to the future, the archaeology show. Wherever you were, welcome.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So
Episode, so we've got our rules, right?
We've got our rules. Yeah. We know what not to do.
Yeah.
Which is basically nothing. We can do whatever we want.
We have our made up rules that we agree with personally because we get to make these rules.
Again, if you're fracturing the timeline, you just made a whole new reality.
Yeah. It's like,
do whatever you want.
Yeah. How does it matter?
I don't know. It's your world now.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, all right. So I would definitely like to visit sites that I've recorded. It sounds kind of boring, but because we've recorded sites that, I mean, on the face of it, there's a few flakes here. Mm-hmm. There's a projectile point. There's maybe a hearth. But I want to know the story behind that.
Yeah. Well, you know me. I've always been interested in like just what the people are doing. What are they doing in central Nevada 10,000 years ago?
Yeah.
Or when I worked in Peru, right? Like 2,000 years ago on the side of a mountain in Peru, in northern Peru. Like, I want to know what life was like and what they're doing because I've excavated those sites and... Mm-hmm. There's a lot of questions because there's always a lot of questions and it just would be really cool to know.
One thing I think would be really cool is to also see, go back specifically with like a site record mapped in with the locations of things that you found and just see how much more stuff there was when the site was initially created.
Oh, sure.
Because there's a lot of things that can move something off a site, especially someplace like Nevada, where they call it a palimpsest of history because you've got sometimes thousands and multi-thousands of years of history sitting on the ground because there's no soil deposition.
Yeah.
That's why we find projectile points sitting there.
Yep.
Now, you got to ask yourself, well, if it's amongst a bunch of others, that's probably the last place it was dropped, right? If it's not, it's just some random projectile point. Then the question becomes, okay, so was this picked up by somebody else?
Mm-hmm.
Was it picked up by some sort of animal?
Yeah.
You know, and
did
moved?
It get stuck in a cow,
right?
Like hoof or whatever?
Was it picked up by a human and they maybe were going to use it because they're like, hey, work I don't have to do.
Yeah.
But then maybe something bad happened to them and they're like, well, I picked up one of the ancestors, you know, things and I better drop this right here because it's bad luck.
Yep.
You know, something like that. So, you know, what's the life cycle of artifacts really, really look like?
Yeah, for
you
sure.
Know? Yeah. We talk about stuff when we record in like valleys and something, and we might find 20 sites. And we're like, oh, these are all separate sites, separate occupations. And if you can prove that from dating, great. Mm-hmm. But often we can't.
Yeah.
And everything is, you know, usually within the same like 1,000 year range because that's the range of projectile points and stuff like that. And I'm like, what if all that was just from like one big site and it was just drug around and people move stuff?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I mean, it's totally possible. Like, so to see the actual context that the artifacts and site were dropped in, were created in, would be really, really interesting. I remember this one artifact I found on a site in, I think it was in South Carolina. Yeah, it was right over the border of North Carolina and South Carolina. And it was an excavation that we were doing there. And what I found was a piece of clay that was fired.
Yeah.
And it was fired in the shape, I'm making a thing with my hand. It's like, so you can't see it, but like a person had taken a piece of clay in their hand and squeezed it.
Yeah.
And it left the impression of the insides of their fingers and like their hand, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you could, the hand was much smaller than mine. So probably a very small woman who had done it would be my guess.
Or kid.
And, but you could put your hand right on it and like be in the lines of the person who did that. And I just, it was such a human connection to that artifact, even though it was like a not significant artifact otherwise, but it was so human to see the imprint of that person's hand. And I'm like, I want to just like go see the person who made that to just know what they were like and what they were doing. Why would you fire a piece of clay that you've squeezed in your hand, you know?
Oh, I have no doubt, because you've told me about that piece.
Yeah.
I've had no doubt that some people were sitting around, it's usually women historically speaking, but they were sitting around a fire, coiling up their pots, because a lot of pots in the past were, you know, linear, like tubes of clay, lines of clay, but they coil them up until they make the pot, and then they smooth down the sides. I have no doubt that some kid ran up and just like grabbed a lump of clay or something, squeezed it and chucked it in the fire.
Yeah. I mean, we're in North Carolina or North South Carolina there. So it's like the land of natural clay to begin with. So there's a lot of it around. So it probably did happen pretty easily naturally, but I just would love to know the context that got that piece where it was for me to find it, you know, however many thousands of years later, maybe that was hundreds. That site wasn't like super old. So anyway,
what's something that is famous in the historical record that you'd like to go see?
The first thing that comes to mind is the mound sites in North America.
Yeah.
I would love to see Cahokia in its heyday or Chillicothe in Ohio or Moundville in Alabama, because all we see now are these big like hills of dirt, right?
Yeah.
But I would love to know, and we make guesses, and we make really good educated guesses about how they were using it and what they were doing. But I would love to just like see what it looked like in its heyday, what they actually did with that space, and then what it would be like to like be a person living in and around these mounds, you know? Because they're not that distinctive now. I mean, they are, but they're not like the built structures that you mm-hmm. see, the stones and things in other communities. So I'm like, how did it develop to the point where it was this built up mound of dirt?
Makes me think of something like Serpent Mound in Southern Ohio,
where
the mouth of the serpent has like a circle in it. It's supposed mm-hmm. to be like a sun or something like mm-hmm. that. At least what people think. And it's supposed to also, if you roll back time a few thousand years, facing the solstice, I don't remember which one, but one of the solstices, and probably the summer solstice. Mm-hmm. And because it's not lined up with that anymore, because, you know, the planet moves. But I would just love to see one of those actual ceremonies. You know, is this the kind of thing where, you know, a few religious elites come over there and they do this thing, you know, for the benefit of the society? Mm-hmm. Or was it like thousands of people joining from all over the place once a year?
I would love to know that.
Yeah. To do this one thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's entirely possible it was only for some kind of religious group, mm-hmm. you know, within the society, and, or it was everybody. It would be great to know. And also it would be great to know like what the actual significance was.
Yeah.
Like, did they really do that so specifically? I mean, it seems like they did.
Yeah.
But it's also like, are we giving it more importance than they did? I would love to know the answer to that question.
Right. Because there's a lot of times, I mean, you just look at buildings in your own city. How many buildings are using their original, are in their original purpose right now?
Mm-hmm.
You know, people move out of the building and something else comes in.
Yeah.
You know, reduce, reuse, and, you know, all that stuff. So we rarely... Well, we try not to tear stuff down anymore. And if it can be remodeled and reused, we'll do it. Mm-hmm. I mean, why wouldn't they have done the same thing in the past with such massive labor intensive efforts?
Yeah, totally.
You know, so, I mean, there are ritual significance on things where you might not want to touch it because, you know, again, it's the ancestors, it's the ancients, it's the past. So, but I'd like to see stuff that maybe doesn't exist anymore, but we know existed, or at least we think.
Oh, that's a good idea. Yeah.
Like, for example, we've talked a number of times about our Greece episodes about the first Parthenon.
Yeah.
There's like, no way you can see that now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. What about the, I'd like to maybe see if there's some early attempts at pyramids in like Egypt or something like that, you know, or better yet, what the pyramids look like again in their heyday.
Yeah.
You know,
because
wasn't the pyramid at Giza and a lot of them supposed to be covered in like this white alabaster or something like that?
Yeah. It was the
just gleaming from the distance.
Marble, I think.
I don't think it was marble.
The cap of one of the pyramids still has the encasing or whatever it was.
Whatever that was.
And it would have been over the entire pyramid, at least that one.
Right.
So it would be so cool to see it like that for sure.
Yeah, that'd be really neat. And I was thinking too about like the Colossus of Rhodes.
Oh.
You know, did that actually exist?
Did it exist? You know? I'm not sure if it did.
What about the Library at Alexandria? We know that existed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That would be amazing. So things that we know were destroyed or burned down, like that would be really cool to see those kind of places because, you know, we have evidence that they were amazing and, you know, something happened and now they're gone. Kind of like the current Parthenon. I would love to see it before the Venetians got a hold of it, you know, and threw a cannonball into the middle of it or whatever they did.
I'd love to go see where the Venetians, you know, Venice, presumably, and go over there and be like that first like raiding party that was about to head out, you know, and head over to Greece, head over to, you know, the Adriatic and just start tearing stuff up.
Yeah.
I just want to see what was that committee meeting like?
Yeah. So that, and again, back to the whole wanting to just like live the life of a human. Yeah. Like, what was it like to be part of a society that was hellbent on conquering all of the land they could get their eyes on? Well,
and that's,
you know,
how we see it in the past, but what was their agenda?
Yeah, that's what I, that's,
you know,
what
was,
I'm,
this some
curious,
kind of religious crusade? They were, they were bound by God to go do this stuff, or were they just jerks? You know, probably not.
Well, no, they probably just, or everybody wanted more power, more money, more influence.
Yeah,
that's always
usually
how that stuff happens. So
usually what it boils down to.
And they were good at it, so they just kept doing it, right? So, but yeah, to be part of that society and to reap the benefits of what they were doing, like what would that have been like?
Yeah. I'd like to see things like, we were talking about one of the Roman agoras in Greece, in Athens, that we saw, where mm-hmm. they tore down a bunch of, you know, locals' houses and filled in a bunch of pits to make this thing because, you know, the goods of the many.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course.
The needs of the many. Yeah.
Yes.
and the goods of the many. Everything was buried. But I was thinking of other stuff of similar significance, like Vatican City is right in the heart of Rome. I've been there. Mm-hmm. And I was like, what was there before that? What did they tear down to make Vatican City?
Yeah, totally.
Because it doesn't look like anything else around it, right? Yeah. It's very special. I'm willing to bet it was probably still Catholic and mm-hmm. religious there, like maybe a smaller church or something, and it just kind of built up.
Yeah, probably.
But how did it become Vatican City?
Yeah.
You know, it's just such a big thing there.
Right.
Peopling in North America.
Yeah.
I want to see that first group of people that
I
got
wanna
here.
I want to know how they did it, for real. Yeah. Like, we've got so many theories, and most of them are bad, but
it would be so
there's
hard.
A couple good ones though.
I know, without some kind of futuristic space age technology where you can throw up a drone or something and find life signs, human life signs, mm-hmm. it would be almost impossible to actually pinpoint where that is.
Oh yeah,
you don't even know where to look.
No, you wouldn't know.
Yeah,
yeah,
you'd have to
monitor the likely suspects,
right.
And yeah, maybe make lots of different timelines so that you can keep track of all of them, I guess. I don't know.
Jumping all over the place.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, for sure.
Anywhere else you'd maybe want to see or go or
well,
do?
Well, I mean, there's all the cliched stuff still. Like, we've talked about a couple of them, but wouldn't you love to see the Colosseum in Rome?
Yeah.
Like, fully together, fully built.
Oh, yeah.
But not just see it complete, but also see a show? Is it a show? A competition?
I would call it a show. It's pretty bad.
Whatever they did in there, I want to see it.
They used to fill it up with water and have sea battles in there.
I want to see that happen. I want to see a sea battle in the Colosseum. I think that would be such an insane thing to experience.
I want to see it being built.
Yeah.
You know?
You love the logistics.
I love it.
You're such a logistics guy. I don't want the logistics. I want the pageantry. Yeah. I want to see
you've got Stonehenge on here. How did they get those Saracen stones up on top there?
Wouldn't you love to see that? That would be.
How did they do it?
That would be very cool. But
how did they even get them there?
But more than that, see your logistics, right? Yeah. I want to know truly once and for all what they were doing there. Why did they build it the way they did
it? Well, it's all ritual.
Of course, but like,
that's an easy answer. Done. What next?
Oh my God. No, I want to know the nuts and bolts of it. I want to know who was doing it. Was it a group of religious people? Was it the entire community? Was it all of the different communities in the outlying area all came together here? And that's why it's so big and massive. I want to know more, the things that we don't have the answer to.
There are two massive construction questions I'd want to know the answer to.
Uh-huh.
That we're always trying to figure out. We think we know, but we don't know.
Yeah.
And we can't know 100% unless we find something that says, this is how we did it.
Yeah.
How did they build the pyramids?
Uh-huh.
And not only that, but how did they build them through time? Because they built pyramids over the course of thousands of years.
Yeah.
So like, did they build them differently 2,000 years later? Mm-hmm. Was that information passed down or was mm-hmm. it lost? I mean, you know, how many times did they have to figure it out? And why can't we figure it out now?
Yeah.
Right. And then also Easter Island.
Oh yeah. That
the
would
heads.
Be... Yeah.
How did they move those?
Yeah.
How did they get them into place? How did they carve them?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just crazy.
We're so different. I want to know. I am curious about how the pyramids were built, but more than the how, I want to know what it was like to be a pyramid builder in Egypt. I want to know what their life was like. Were they really treated terribly? Were they more like slaves, or was it an actual, like, you know, was it like going into the military where you have a solid career for 20 years or whatever building pyramids? I want to know what that life was like. And kind of the same for Easter Island, the heads. I want to know why they did it and what the purpose was and what the rituals around it look like. So,
all right, well,
we make a good pair, I guess. Well, you go learn the logistics and I'll observe the people and, like, you know, figure out what they were doing from a cultural perspective.
There you go. Well, Rachel, we're going to go back in time. Rachel's going to be in there as an anthropologist and I'm going to be a project manager. And
there you go. Perfect.
We'll figure it out.
Yeah, definitely.
All right.
There's so many places though. I couldn't even list all the different places that we'd want to go. I mean, I'm curious to hear what other people are interested in too. So send your ideas on where you'd want to go, or come over. If you're a member, come over to the Slack channel and we can talk about the kind of places that you want to go visit and the things that you want to learn from the past when we become time travelers over on the Slack channel.
Absolutely. And if you don't know what we're talking about with the Slack channel, go to arcpednet.com/members.
Mm-hmm.
There should be some sort of login button there. If you're on any page, it'll say login down in the lower right-hand corner.
Mm-hmm.
You can do that. And if you're not a member, it'll ask you to become a member. And then you can join in the conversation.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. With that, we'll see you guys next week.
Bye.
Hey,
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at ArcPodNet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.